So I've noticed that there is a type of regret that has nothing to do with something you did. It's the regret of finding something out that you wish you didn't find out. And it starts in these small ways. Like maybe you read an article or a friend told you something about how a particular food product gets made, for example. And now you find yourself standing in the grocery aisle holding a package of something that you used to enjoy. And now you just can't anymore because that information lives inside you now, where it has made an irritating permanent address in your brain. And I think about this a lot because there's this moment right before you knew something, and then that moment's gone, and you can't get it back no matter what you do. There's this quote that everybody's heard at some point or other that gets passed around like it means something comforting. Ignorance is bliss. And people put this on coffee mugs and they use it to justify not watching the news or paying attention to the various horrors happening in the world, understandably. So, ignorance is bliss actually comes from a poem that was written in 1742 by a man named Thomas Gray. And almost nobody who quotes this poem knows that he wasn't endorsing ignorance. He was actually grieving ignorance. So the full poem it's basically about watching kids who don't yet know what's coming for them. When you grow up and you experience the heartbreak, the failure, the whole, I guess, beautiful slow motion train wreck of being alive. And the speaker can't decide if this is sweet or just a tragedy. That's the conundrum. So you could argue that the line we inherited as life advice is actually, this line that we've inherited, it's actually like a punchline to a really long tragic comedy. Seems about right from a certain perspective. So, all right, so this poem is called Ode on a Distant Prospect of Eton College, which already is not a title that fits on a coffee mug, right? Okay, so Thomas Gray, he's standing outside his old school, sort of pensively watching children play, and instead of feeling nostalgic and warm about it, he's basically watching them from a distance, and he's thinking, damn. They have no idea. They have no idea what's waiting. And there is this specific line of the poem near the end where that goes like this: where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise. And that's the whole thing. Pretty much. I mean, that's what got turned into the bumper sticker. But when you read this, in context, it's not really advice. It's more like a man standing at a window, slightly drunk on his own sadness, watching people who haven't been ruined yet. And the bliss that he's describing, it isn't a lifestyle choice. It's more like a countdown. And it's like that silence before something breaks, like, you know, the calm before the storm. So I think what happened is that we needed the comfort more than we needed the accuracy. So what we did, we basically took the part that felt good, and then we discreetly dropped the rest, which is honestly a pretty human thing to do, right? I mean, you know, we cherry pick a lot of things in our lives. I mean, it could be, I don't know, religious text. We do it with science. Things people said at their own funerals. I mean, there's a multitude of examples of this selective bias that we partake in. So we basically clip the part that helps us sleep at night, I guess. And then we move on. Now, the thing is, Gray, he knew something. And just abstractly, he'd watched his friends die young. He spent a lot of his life in, I guess you could say, varying degrees of unhappiness. I mean, he never published much. He wrote maybe a dozen poems total his entire life. Not exactly prolific. Now, it's fair to say that the man was not operating from a position of bliss, informed or otherwise. So when he looks at those kids playing and he says, yeah, not knowing is probably better for them right now, it's not really wisdom. It's exhaustion. Exhaustion that's wearing wisdom's coat. So here's the thing that I keep getting stuck on. And I'll be honest, I mean, I didn't want to get stuck on this part because it's a little uncomfortable. Or maybe I did. I'll let you decide. There's actual research that strongly suggests that people with the most accurate self-perception are mildly depressed. Like, they see themselves clearly. They see their situation clearly, and that clarity is a kind of, well, what it does is it sits on them like a weight. And, you know, I guess that's the price of having this clarity. So there's a name for this. It's called depressive realism. And it's not just some, you know, this isn't just some fringe idea, because this has actually been replicated enough times that psychologists mostly accept it, and then, you know, they don't want to talk about it as social functions. So I think this implies, you know, what this implies is, I think it's pretty unsettling that the people functioning best in society, feeling okay, you know, moving through their day without that low-grade dread, a lot of these people are running on a slightly edited version of reality. Now, I wouldn't say it's delusional by and large. It's lightly optimistic in ways that the evidence doesn't fully support. And when I think about this, I'm not quite sure what to do with it. So Nietzsche had this idea that truth wasn't inherently valuable, and that what people actually need to survive and to keep going are what he called useful fictions. So what these are, they're stories that we tell ourselves that aren't quite accurate, but they are, you know, in some way supportive. But if you take these stories away, something structural basically collapses, which might sound like a justification for lying to yourself, and maybe it is, but I think about people who I've known who have, you know, relentlessly pursued self-awareness, reading everything, examining everything, and several of them are exhausting to be around, frankly. And it's not necessarily because they're wrong. It's because they're right. And they just can't, they don't have an off switch. Okay, so there is this version of Aldous Huxley's book, Brave New World, where the citizens, they're genuinely content. They're not tortured or secretly miserable. They're pretty much just, I guess, fine. And, well, the horror of the book, it's not that they're suffering. It's that they're not suffering. And that's what disturbs you. That contentment got there through managed ignorance, and it worked somehow. So I think the question, it's not really whether ignorance can produce bliss, because apparently it can. I think the question is whether that really matters. And I think part of why that question is so hard to sit with is because, well, we are not really built for abstract cost-benefit analysis when it comes to our own comfort. Like, knowing that your contentment might be partially constructed, it doesn't automatically dismantle it. You know, you can understand that depressive realism, you can understand it intellectually, right? And still feel fine on a Thursday or whatever. So the information just coexists with the feeling, which is either reassuring or deeply weird, depending on what kind of day you're having, I guess. There's also this other thing that nobody really talks about, which is that the people who are most invested in this idea that ignorance is bliss are usually not the ignorant ones. It's always someone else's ignorance being romanticized. The philosopher nodding warmly at the people who didn't study philosophy, or the person who's read everything, quietly envying the person who hasn't, which I think suggests that what we're actually romanticizing isn't ignorance itself. It's the relief of not being responsible for what you know. And I think that's a slightly different problem. So, on the other hand of, or the other side of this, we have Socrates, who famously said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And yeah, that line gets quoted at graduation ceremonies and slapped on inspirational posters and what have you. But here's the context that nobody seems to mention. Socrates said this at his own funeral, right before they sentenced him to death, for essentially knowing too much and asking too many questions out loud. So, the man who gave us arguably the most celebrated argument for self-knowledge and examined living was killed by it. And he still thought it was worth it. Now, I'm not sure if that's a noble thing or just a very committed bit or something, but whatever the case, the man certainly had integrity. And and then there is Dostoevsky, who in his book Notes from Underground wrote this character, the underground man, who's probably the most honest portrait of what happens when you take consciousness all the way to its, I guess, terminal point. So this character is aware of everything, every motive. He's aware of every social dynamic, every layer of his own self-deception, and it has completely destroyed his ability to function. I mean, he can't act or connect. He just basically circles endlessly, brilliantly. He's alone in a basement writing notes that nobody asked for. But Dostoevsky wasn't celebrating him. He wasn't dismissing him either, because the underground man isn't, he wasn't really wrong about anything. He's just completely right and completely miserable. And those two things ultimately turned out to be the same thing. And I think about this a lot lately because I think we are living in a time where this conflict between ignorance and hyper awareness, it's intensifying. Due mostly to the events that are that we're seeing in the world now. So John Stuart Mill had this line, "Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied," which sounds, I think that sounds correct. and sounds like something most people would probably agree with. And then you watch someone genuinely, uncomplicatedly enjoy something that you've analyzed the meaning out of. And you think, huh, maybe this fool's having a better Saturday than me. Because knowing more, it doesn't necessarily make you kinder. It doesn't always make you more effective or more present or easier to have dinner with or whatever. And a lot of the time, it just makes you more anxious. And yeah, probably a little harder to be around. Which isn't an argument against knowing things, of course. It's just something that nobody's going to put on the poster, you know, next to the Socrates quote. I think there's this this gap between knowledge, or what knowledge promises and what it actually delivers day to day. And it's a kind of, I think it's a pretty significant gap, like structurally significant. I think it's the kind that once you notice it, and you can't stop noticing, which, you know, it seems to be how this works. So I think what we've actually been circling this whole time, it's not really about information. It's about something, I think it's about something a little harder to name, because the real question underneath all of this is, does knowing the truth about something make your life better? Or does it just make your life more accurate? And those aren't the same thing. All right, so the Greek philosopher Plato had this thought experiment that's known as the allegory of the cave. So there's a group of people chained in a cave their entire lives. They're facing a wall and they're watching shadows. That's pretty much all they can see. And this is all they know. This is all they've ever known. That is their reality. And then one of these people gets loose and walks out of the cave and sees actual sunlight for the first time, like actual objects, the whole vast thing. And then, and this is the part that usually gets glossed over, he naturally goes back into the cave to tell everyone, because of course he would, right? And how do they respond to him? They want to kill him. And not metaphorically speaking. I mean, Plato was pretty specific about, that the people in the cave would kill whoever came back trying to tell them that the shadows weren't real. And the guy who got out, well, I mean, he can't go back to watching the shadows, right? I mean, that's over for him. So he's kind of stuck, because now he's had this epiphany or revelation or whatever, and he's just too awake for the cave. And standing alone in a field somewhere, technically enlightened, which I guess, congratulations. So Plato, he frames this as noble. And maybe it is, but it's also just a story about how knowledge cuts you off from people who don't have it yet, or and people who don't want it. And of course, that part doesn't make the inspirational poster. Then there's Albert Camus. We're jumping ahead a couple thousand years now. And Camus looked at all of this and said, yeah, none of this really means anything inherently. The universe isn't, it's not indifferent to you specifically. It's just indifferent, full stop. And once you've actually sat with that, and I mean really sat with it and let it sink in, not as an intellectual position, but as something that you feel alone in the middle of the night, you can't unsit with it. And Camus said this was clarifying that you could live well inside of that absurdity and even build something meaningful inside of it. And I think, from a certain perspective, he might be right. Unfortunately, he also died in a car crash at age 46, and we'll never really know how that philosophy would have held up for him in the long term. Now, that's not meant to be a criticism. It's just, it's the kind of detail that sticks with you, I guess. I'm genuinely not sure whether the examined life is better or just louder. More furnished, maybe. More rooms. Worse sleep. I mean, you know more. You feel more. You notice more. And at some point, you're exposed to the news about genocide or the Epstein files or the fact that sociopaths are in the possession of nuclear codes, and you're thinking, I really wish I didn't know this. Because the cave was at least warm, and you probably were, in fact, blissfully ignorant in that situation. So there's something sitting underneath all of this that I haven't really mentioned yet. And I think it's probably the most uncomfortable part here. Blissful ignorance has mostly been something imposed on people rather than chosen by them. So what this means is historically that the people who got to not know things were not the ones doing the not knowing voluntarily. It was managed for them by someone else who benefited from that arrangement. And I think that's worth just pondering for a few moments, because when we romanticize not knowing, we're usually just imagining it as a, well, we think of it as a personal choice. It's a kind of luxury. And for a lot of people in a lot of places in the world, for a lot of our history, it wasn't a choice at all. I mean, it was a cage that someone else built and called a gift. So whether the question, well, I guess, let me put it this way. So the question of whether ignorance is bliss, I think it kind of depends on who's deciding what you get to know. And whether you'd choose it yourself if the option were really on the table for you. Something to think about. And, you know, most of the time, the option isn't on the table. And I'm not quite sure that there's a clean answer to any of this. I've been turning it over for a while now, and I keep arriving at generally the same place, which is, it's not really a question about information, it's a question about what you can tolerate and what you can do with what you know once you have it. Because I think the actual problem, it isn't knowing too much or knowing too little. I think the problem is knowing things and having nowhere to put them. That's difficult. And that's the specific kind of misery that nobody really names. You read something, you understand something, and then you have to carry it with no outlet or context, no community of people who are carrying the same thing. So if there's anything that might resemble some path through this, and I want to be careful here because I'm not interested in wrapping this up in a bow. I think it's something like this. Being deliberate about what you let in, and not in a denial way or a I'm just not going to read the news way, because that's not really a philosophy. That's just a avoidance with a nicer name, right? But maybe just noticing the difference between knowledge that connects you to something and knowledge that just accumulates. Now, one of those has to go, one of those has somewhere to go. And the other just sits in you like that grocery store information, permanent address, no rent, no plans to leave. And maybe, finding even just one or two people who are on a similar wavelength, carrying similar things, not to fix it, just so you're not standing in that field by yourself. Technically enlightened, waiting for someone to care, right? And I think that there's something worth saying about the difference between chosen awareness and imposed awareness. Because sometimes you don't get to decide what you know. Someone tells you something, or you read something somewhere, or you just, maybe you just live long enough and the information arrives whether you wanted it or not. And the whole ignorance is bliss conversation kind of assumes you had a choice in the matter, when a lot of the time you didn't. You were just standing there, and then suddenly you knew something, and well, now here we are. Which maybe reframes the whole question slightly, because if a lot of what we know arrived uninvited, then the real skill isn't deciding how much to know. It's figuring out what to do with what's already in there. The stuff that already has the permanent address. And that's not a philosophy I've seen on a coffee mug yet. Anyway. Probably because it doesn't fit. And probably because it's true. And that's not nothing. All right, I guess that's all I've got today. As I always say, thank you so much for listening.